This is Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Streaming nationwide on the 710 Sports app and 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Try to put on the show.
It is Danny and Gallant. Paul has just posted online the picture of Pet Edelman. I'm putting up a dialogue. You see him with a... It's not fully a leash because it's not around his throat. It's around his waist, but there is a rope that he's tying, that Tom Brady is holding. The caption I'm going to put is, "Curl, Julian, curl! Good boy."
Is that what you said, Simba?
Good boy. Yeah, that's exactly right. Sit, stay, wait, good job.
Sit, Ubu, sit. Good dog.
How do you approach the draft if you're the Seahawks? You have three picks. You have a team that is built to win right now. One of the reason you have so few picks is because you traded a first and a third round pick to acquire a safety who everybody expects, we expect you're going to extend. You have a quarterback who now appears, especially since in this morning's hype video, he's wearing a Seahawks helmet. There's not much uncertainty about where he's going to be next season, but I think it's fair to say that his long-term future, there's more doubt about that than there's been at any point in his 9 years as a Seahawk. Like this is regardless of how likely you think a trade or a change would be next year or the year after that, this is more doubt than there's ever been since they drafted him, since he emerged, about how long the relationship might last. Is there an expiration date on this? Does it change how you draft? Does it change how you use that uncertainty about Russell Wilson and how you should expect your team to look 2 or 3 years from now?
You should be more aggressive with this second round pick than you maybe would be in other years. I think you should look at this, given that you don't have many draft picks this year, you have to wonder about what kind of impact you were going to get from your rookies. And yeah, it's probably the smarter play to trade that second round pick back to get more draft picks and just try to get as many young players at reasonable contracts and hope that you maybe hit on one of them over the next couple of seasons. But I look at this second round pick, Danny, as an opportunity for the Seahawks. If there is somebody that is out there that might be available on the trade block, to keep on going with this let's trade draft picks for veterans approach, because they've gone about this way for the last two seasons. And for the most part, they have hit on the trades that they have made. I know some people would argue with Jadeveon Clowney because it was for a third round pick, but I thought he contributed for that 1 year. Quinton Dunbar was a miss, but Quandre Diggs, nope, not a miss. I'm intrigued by Gabe Jackson. Carlos Dunlap, not a miss. On top of that, the Jamal Adams trade, he was your best defensive player last year, no matter how you feel about what you gave up to get him. They have gone aggressive when it comes to using draft picks to acquire veterans. And I think a veteran is going to help the Seahawks more in 2021 than anyone that they are likely going to find with that pick at the back of the second round. I know the counter argument is, yeah, but DK Metcalf. Great. That doesn't happen every single year. You might have already used your lucky, hey, look at me. I can find a guy at the back of the second round card already.
So your answer is that if anything, this should increase the urgency and create more of a sense to, hey, our window's now. Like, let's not worry about what happens 3 or 4 years from now so much as maximizing our chance to win in 2021. Like, that should be the priority. Yes, we've already done that by trading a first and a third round pick this year for a safety. And we're going to, if there's an opportunity to get another guy that'll make us better, we'll figure out tomorrow. Is there a counter argument to be made that now is the point to start laying out potential alternative routes for you?
You better,
as a franchise,
you better have a really good idea, Danny, of one of those quarterbacks, if that's the route that I think you're going with. And that's likely going to be just based off of the few mock drafts I've looked at and rankings. Supposedly Kyle Trask and Davis Mills from Stanford, Kyle Trask from Florida, are the two quarterbacks that are in that, hey, second round, third round, fourth round range that maybe if the Seahawks really like them, maybe they take one of those two, but you have to love them. Like, you have to absolutely jump up on a table for them, love them, if you are going to go that route. And I'm pretty skeptical, just having watched Kyle Trask as someone who watches Gator games on the reg. And, of course, you've seen, you know, Davis Mills at Stanford, too, in the Pac-12 North. I have a hard time thinking that John Schneider is going to do that.
This is one of the few times where I think storyline matters. a quarterback can't be the first player you choose in this draft. I don't care when that pick is. I don't care if it's trading up or if it's trading back. A quarterback cannot be the first player you choose in this draft. Because whatever chance you have of continuing the relationship with Russell Wilson for the next 6 or 7 years, having this contract plus another one, I think it would spoil that. If the first player you choose in the draft is a quarterback, I think it takes that. And I'm not sure what the likelihood is now that you would say he remains, that Russell remains with this team beyond the current contract, beyond the next 3 years. But whatever chance is there, this would light that on fire.
You would definitely make him mad.
Yes. And it matters, doesn't it? Doesn't it matter? Like, your goal as the franchise right now should be that we weather this storm. And it becomes like Kobe Bryant when he asked to be traded or wanted to be traded or threw his public fit back in 2007 or 2008. Like, your goal as the franchise should be to weather the storm, right?
It should be. And it depends, though, on if you look at the current situation as a storm or as something that's popping up on the radar as a storm but isn't actually one. And there's a part of me that wonders if the Seahawks are viewing the entirety of this offseason the same way that we are, or if this isn't just two people, which is the vibe I'm getting, where Mark Rogers and John Schneider have an extremely acrimonious relationship that has just spilled out into the open. You know, like, that's the vibe I get really from this, more so than necessarily, hey, Russ is about to force his way out of town. And I think there is a case to be made that, yeah, Russ has not said stop all this stuff. But there is also, I think, an element of, I don't know that Russ wanted to go as far as some of these things actually ended up going out in the public. And if they were to draft the quarterback, are they going to really make him mad to the point where he's not going to want to play? Because the only way he gets out of town is if he decides that he's going to sit. We would have seen that. This is what, I mean, there is a part of me from a just objective football perspective that was really curious to see what was going to happen with Deshaun Watson. Now that has just been entirely changed by all the allegations against him. If he does not want to sit out, and I just don't think he is the kind of guy that is going to want to willingly sit out any of his time in his 30s to make a point to get himself to another team, even if the Seahawks were to draft a quarterback over the next year, this draft after this one, you know, I don't feel like he is the kind of quarterback that would all of a sudden, to make a point, say, I'm just not playing.
Let's go back to what you just said, where Russell didn't want it necessarily to get this far. I agree with you about that. And I think that everything we've seen and what we heard from Carlos Dunlap about how he talked to Russ before his decision to resign, I think that's likely, that this got out further than Russell would have wanted it. And probably the one step was the releasing his agent telling ESPN the four teams that he would accept a trade to. Not that he was asking for a trade, but if he was going to be traded, here's four teams that he would be okay being traded. That was it. He wishes that that hadn't happened, because that kicked this into sort of a level of urgency or a level of speculation that he didn't want. If you're the Seahawks and you know that, you want things to settle further, right? Like, that would be the goal of, like, okay, let's let everything settle down. And for me, the question is, I think you can make a really compelling argument that now is the time for Seattle to start looking at potential alternatives at quarterback. Not just to replace Russell Wilson, but look, he's been incredibly healthy, like all of those different things. But at the same time, you're at a point where it would never be more disastrous. Like, it would never be more harmful to your relationship with the player to draft someone at that position, regardless of the logic, regardless of the, hey, your agent gave four teams that you might want to be traded to, so we're stupid if we don't at least consider the possibility that this is that. As a franchise, it's almost like it's not about logic. It's about the emotional. It's about your EQ and, like, doing something to make sure you're sort of to appease and make sure that it's a goodwill gesture, whether it's an olive branch or whatever you would want to say. And I can end up falling down on that side of it, which is, yeah, they should make the olive branch. Do not do something that is going to antagonize this. Do not, even if it makes sense from a lot of different angles, do not do it because of the cost that it would have if you draft a quarterback in a high position in this draft, and certainly if a quarterback is the first player you choose in this draft.
If Russ was a couple of years older, we could make parallels to New England drafting Jimmy Garoppolo, to the Packers drafting Jordan Love because he is 32, 33 years old. That's the spot where you can't quite do that. And
it's his next contract. Right. It's his next contract when there's 3 years left in it that you can start saying of like, look, we love you and we want it to last as long as you can. But we're you can't play the we need to plan for your successor yet, because the hope is that he plays the next 7 or 8 years with you. Right. Before we even get into how long do you want to play? The hope is that you want him to play those next few with you.
Right. And I think they will be able to get him to play with them. I just don't think that he, as someone who looks at his legacy the way that he does, is going to say, I hate it here so much, I'm just not playing. You know, I feel like he's too much of a competitor to actually compete in the way that he would need to get out of a contract with a certain team.
It's Michael Bumpus talks to us all the time about, hey, you have different approaches for different players, right? Like the way you coach one guy is not the same way you coach the other guy, and it's based on that player's personality. There's a little bit of the same thing that's going on here. The decisions you make about the future of your team in this regard, you kind of have to treat your quarterback a little bit differently. And because I had someone tell me, like, hey, if I was in charge of Seattle, and what I think Seattle should do is take him at his word and totally load up for a fist fight. And say, like, if you're going to throw this fit every offseason, we're going to pretend we're looking for a successor every offseason. And that if you don't, you're showing him weakness, and you're basically adding to the entitlement or the feeling that he can do whatever he wants, and he's going to be your quarterback as long as he deigns to do so. I think looking at Russell's personality, I think that's the wrong way to go about it. And I would point for an example to what he did at NC State, which is basically his coach there, Tom O'Brien, tried to get him to do what he wanted, which was give up baseball. And Russell's like, I'm not doing that. I'm not doing that. And who ended up coming out of that worse for wear? Russell went to the Rose Bowl. Tom O'Brien ended up losing his job a couple years down the road. Now, some of that's because he drastically overrated Mike Glennon, and he deserves to lose his job. He deserves to lose it for that. But it is, there's, I think Russell's personality, if you dare him to bet on himself, he absolutely will every single time. If you dare him, like, oh, is this what you really want? He'd be like, yeah, this is not the first time that I've seen a team try to draw a line in the sand. You're not going to tell me what to do. You're not going to define the limits of what I can do for me. Like, that's up to me.
They have not done that.
No. They've just been quiet, right?
Right.
That's what makes the draft so, because they've been able to lay low. And this is, the draft is going to be one of the first opportunities that we get to see of like, how do you view your team? Do you view your team as this is Russell Wilson's team for the next 5 or 6 years? Or do you look at it of like, we want to win this year and then we'll see what happens next year?
I feel like they have to look at it the same way they look at it every single year, which is just to approach it in the exact same way that they approach it. And I don't know how that's going to make Russell Wilson feel. The odds of them drafting a quarterback there, as amusing as it would be to see it take place from a theatric standpoint, not from a, hey, the Seahawks are getting better as a football team perspective, I have such a hard time, Danny, seeing it happen. Like, I think it's practically 1%, if that, that they would decide to go in that direction with that pick.
The 509 has it absolutely. Let's let Russ simmer a bit.
Right.
Draft a quarterback in the 5th round, and we're just going to let Russ simmer a little bit.
Put a top over that pan.
It's Danny and Gallon. It's time for us to go around the NFL.
It's time to go around the NFL. The bottom line on the biggest stories in the NFL every morning at 9:15 with Danny and Gallon.
Today's an exceptional day.
What's going on, Morduli?
Oh, not much. How are you guys?
We're doing well. We've recovered from our shouting.
You have. It all worked out. I think people kind of like the shouting match.
We might have to do something at 7:30s in the future where we just yell at each other for a little bit.
Yeah. Just let it all out. I'm surprised people want to start their day that early like that, but I think it got a good response.
It's an aggressive cup of coffee.
We call it the double shot?
Yeah. Might be a triple shot. Have you ever had, by the way, a triple shot of coffee? Like, I had one a little bit ago. I did not know it was a triple shot until afterwards, and I felt like I was having heart palpitations for a good, like, 3 hours, to the point where I was concerned.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's coming from me, as you guys can all tell, someone who is very well attuned when it comes to caffeine.
I used to just live off Red Bull when I was bartending and going to school. Yeah.
It smells like radioactive cough syrup.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I can't deal with Red Bull.
No, I can't either.
Yeah, I got over that. I don't think it was good for me. All right, guys. First up, ESPN Bucks reporter Jenna Lane says Giovanni Bernard was also recruited by the 49ers and Seahawks. Not only did Tom Brady and Bruce Arians call him, but he heard from Pete Carroll and Russell Wilson as well.
This is tongue-in-cheek, and I want people to understand that it's tongue-in-cheek, because one person this morning told me that this is everything wrong with your generation, the way that you would like to have something that you cannot have. I'm just annoyed that the Buccaneers keep out-recruiting the Seahawks. That's it. I don't know that Giovanni Bernard would have had any impact on the Seattle Seahawks that would have been noteworthy, but I look at that, the Bucs out-recruited Bruce Arians and Tom Brady, out-recruited Pete Carroll and Tom Brady, and it annoys me. That's it.
I would encourage you to lop off the first part of what you just said, responding to the idiot texter, and embrace and lean into that, and just say, like, I'm tired of Tom Brady winning recruiting battles. Yeah. I'm tired of that. Yeah. Let's go.
Yeah.
I shrug. Let Tampa Bay recruit all of the older, broke-down dudes. I'm fine with that. I think that the NFL is chock full of examples of teams that buy guys based on brand name rather than how much football ability they have left. And I include Giovanni Bernard. What role was he going to play for the Seahawks? Is he going to be their third down back? I guess he could catch out of the backfield somewhat, maybe. But Travis Homer's pretty good at pass protection.
Oh, God, stop. Rashad Penny probably needs someone to compete with him.
Sure.
Bernard's more competition than, I think, either DJ Dallas or Travis Homer to this phase.
This is just one of those where I go like, meh, okay, fine. Another retirement or another member of the Tampa retirement community.
I agree in that meh, but I'm annoyed that they won on this one.
I don't know what he would contribute on the field, but I know for sure he would have the best mustache on the team.
His mustache is awesome. Oh, my goodness. I looked at his stats on Pro Football Reference, and I was completely distracted from his stats because of that mustache.
Yeah, it is an old school Rudy Ray Moore style mustache. It is solid.
And another running back off the board. James Conner, the former Steelers running back, visited the Cardinals yesterday. They've announced that he is signing with them today.
He's a cool story because he beat cancer. He is also a cool story because he stepped in for Le'Veon Bell and, at least from a production standpoint, did just about as much. But like many running backs, he had his couple of years and then all of a sudden fell back to the rest of the pack.
The Steelers, more than any other team, might be the team that I don't want to sign free agents from. Is it Plaxico Burress that's the last free agent that's left there and really improved or been a difference maker elsewhere? I mean, constantly, it was for years, it was their outside linebacker. Like, you take their pass rushing outside linebacker, whether it's Jason Gildon or the other guys that they had, and you watch him absolutely wither elsewhere. Chad Brown was good here in Seattle, but he was never as good as he was with Pittsburgh.
They've had a million wide receivers, from Emmanuel Sanders to Santonio Holmes to
Randall
Burris, Antoine Randall L. Yeah, they've had so many receivers go through there to the point where you do have to give Ben Roethlisberger a lot of credit
for
what he made happen with all of those guys. But I would more specifically, Danny, think about the actual wide receivers leaving Pittsburgh than I would maybe about the running backs.
Who's gone on? Le'Veon Bell wasn't better with the Jets than he was in Pittsburgh.
That year off.
Yeah.
I wonder what would have
happened. It jacks everything up.
Right.
Yeah, I agree with you. I loved the way he ran before that.
I did too.
But what other guys have we said? Like Barry Foster? I mean, it doesn't. I don't know, man. I'm not sure how many guys that were that good have left Pittsburgh. They had Bettis, and Bettis thrived when he was there.
Off the top of my head, I can't really think of any.
The NFLPA is advising players not to attend OTAs and advocating for an all-virtual offseason. NFLPA President J.C. Treader told Tom Pelissero, "We've been telling them it's voluntary and we're not going to go."
You can't tell that to a guy who is a fringe roster player. You can't. that guy, this is his opportunity to make a team, and for him to tell him to not go to OTAs and give himself every single possible advantage to make the team, I understand why the PA wants it to happen, but you're asking the players that are at the bottom of the totem pole to risk themselves for a greater good that they might not be a part of.
As someone who, I feel like I need to advocate for organized labor even when their position's stupid. And this is one of those where the NFLPA has essentially lost on significant issues such as the 17th game being added to the schedule where they just basically rolled over. And they've won on meaningless concessions when it comes to how much time they spend there in the offseason. And I don't know if the majority of their players are actually against off-season conditioning and training, or if it's that the prominent guys whose space on a roster is not contingent upon their involvement in off-season training that don't care about it. Right? Like, I believe that Aaron Rodgers wants a shorter off-season. I'm not sure that guys 35 through 65 on an NFL roster want less off-season training. And in that way, I think that the NFLPA can skew toward its toward the guys that already get the most out of its players, as opposed to the guys that are most worried about 3-3, which is 3 years, three games when you qualify for your pension.
Maybe once you qualify for your pension, you should have the option of not showing up. But the problem is, too, it's not about whether or not you go or what you actually accomplish there. Isn't it more about, are you going to make the roster, period, end of story, like, or question mark? And that's the problem.
Don't we want to go back to work? Like, all of us that are still working at home and working from home, don't we want to go back to work? Like, I'm sick of this. I am sick of it.
Yeah, I would. I would.
Hey, go ahead and stay home. Forget you, J.C. Treader. I want to go out into the world.
It is hard to focus when you're at home.
Ah!
That's my big issue with it at this point in time.
Somebody was asking, what's the future of offices in America? It's like, the future is going back to the offices. Does anybody like this? Are there people who actually prefer it?
Bunch of texters, by the way, are bringing up that the Seahawks signed Franco Harris away.
They didn't sign Franco Harris. They signed his carcass. Like, they signed they signed a Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade that was wearing Franco Harris's number.
Oh, wow. All-time
fear. They signed the husk of a human being. The husk of a football player is what they acquired. It's Danny and Gallant. Biggest Lies in Seattle Sports is coming up next.
You are listening to Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
The days of kings and queens. Line from the song by Atmosphere. We talked about this in the first hour. Joe West won $500,000 judgment. Umpire Joe West, Cowboy Joe West won $500,000 judgment because Paul LaDuca made up a giant story about him that made him look bad. Told it on the radio, said that Joe West gave Billy Wagner an extra wide strike zone because Wagner let him drive a sports car around, and it turned out that the story that LaDuca gave was completely made up because the incident he described in which Wagner struck out the side on 10 pitches, most of which were well off the plate, never actually occurred. So he asked the question of the greatest lies in Seattle sports history.
The first one, by default, has to be something involving Clay Bennett, the Seattle Supersonics. I don't think there's any debating that.
So. And just the whole idea that they asked us to believe that that ownership group had not really talked about relocating the franchise or when they could relocate it or how it would go about it. I will now read, and this came out in the course of the city's suit against the ownership group, on August 17th, 2007, Clay Bennett sent this email to David Stern, and it came after Aubrey McClendon, who was a member of the ownership group, had basically said, we did not buy that team to leave it in Seattle. He was quoted as saying that, and it became this huge deal. Here's what Clay Bennett, and they said afterwards, Aubrey's not speaking for the ownership group. But he told a reporter, that he knew was quoting him, that we did not buy that team to leave it in Seattle. This is what Clay Bennett wrote on April 17th to David Stern. Is there an absolutely remarkable as it may seem, Aubrey and I have never discussed moving the Sonics to Oklahoma City, nor have I discussed it with any other member of our ownership group. He said that. He said, and to show you the depth of that lie, here is an email that was sent exactly 4 months prior to that. And it was between Tom Ward and Clay Bennett. Tom Ward was also a member of the ownership group. Ward writes, "Is there any way to move here for next season, or are we doomed to have another lame duck season in Seattle?" Question mark. Bennett's response, "I am a man possessed!" Exclamation point. "We'll do everything we can. Thanks for hanging with me, boys. The game is getting started!" Exclamation point. So it would appear that at the very least, that is discussing the relocation of the Sonics to Oklahoma City 4 months before he sent an email to David Stern saying that he had never discussed it with any member of his ownership group. A liar!
That's generally what owners do, isn't it? And this city has had quite the experience with ownership, whether it's Ken Behring buying the Seahawks away from the Nordstroms and promising that he was never going to try to move the team out of town, only in 1996 to try to move the team out of town. I can't even keep track of all of the names that were in charge of the Mariners before they were able to get the stadium built. Was Smullyan? Is that how you pronounce his
Smullyan.
Last name? Smullyan.
Smullyan.
Right.
Yeah.
Read about him. That's something else. And you said a little bit earlier, we discussed it, about how this is, I guess, a West Coast thing as far as just the battle between cities and ownership groups of sports teams as they try to get stadiums built by the county. It's, I think, interesting that Clay Bennett would go that route when this city is so well-versed in the lies that people say when it comes to keeping teams around.
All right. So that's lie number one. Biggest lie that's ever been told in Seattle sports was Clay Bennett claiming that they fully intended to keep the Sonics in Seattle. Lie number two, and this one's a little hazier, it's Alex Rodriguez. Everybody will tell you that Alex said before he became a free agent that it wasn't going to be about the money. I'm not going to say that that's false. I have not been able to find the direct quote in which he stated that explicitly, in which he said money isn't an object. I did find this quote, and it's from the offseason before the final year of his contract, where the Mariners were talking about extending. There was debates about what was going to happen, and all of the Ken Griffey Jr.'s future, like all of that is sort of coming to the surface. And here is a direct quote from Alex Rodriguez that said, "If they go out and get all the pieces, sure, I'd be more than willing to sign with the Mariners. I've always said that's where I want to be under the right conditions. And the right conditions are having a championship ball club." So that's him entering the final year of his contract. Now, that year, they went out and they came. They were 2 wins away from making the World Series that year. They beat the White Sox in the first round of the playoffs. They played in the American League Championship Series. They fell behind in that series to the Yankees. They tied it at one game apiece after winning the opener. They come back after falling behind 3-1. They led the it was 3-2 and then they lost it. So all of that happened. Did Alex lie? Because then that offseason he went and took a mammoth offer that was the biggest offer that was made to him. And afterwards he said, "Texas really won it, but the Mariners made it a lot easier by the way they treated me," end quote. And did his best through various different sources to paint it as if Seattle had been uninterested and unserious about retaining him.
Would you feel that they were unserious about retaining you, though, if you are that kind of a talent and the other team just blew your offer out of the water the way that they did? Because the Rangers were willing to reset the market entirely for A-Rod, who, by the way, at that point, I mean, one of the most gifted baseball players we've ever seen, even if there are some questions about how good he was in the postseason at that point in his career. He was offered, I mean, the offer blew the Mariners' offer way out of the water. I can understand why afterwards A-Rod felt that way, even if that's the incorrect way to feel. Because by those words, that is a lie.
He should have just talked about Texas's offer, right? And the problem, and this is a problem a lot of athletes fall into, is that they try to engender support in the city that they're leaving by making it seem there wasn't their choice. That this was something that that team did to me. The Mariners wanted him back. They were not willing to give him what Texas gave him. He's not wrong to take the bigger financial offer. The problem, and I guess I don't know if I'd say he full-fledged lied, but he's definitely operating in this gray area of he had told people he wanted to remain on one team. He had said that the biggest thing was winning a championship, like all of these different things. And then ultimately, well, he went out and the main criteria of what he did was about the money, the size of the contract, which is fine. But hey, don't then say it wasn't the main criteria. And don't afterwards then say, well, the Mariners didn't really want me because they didn't give me as much money.
That part, though, I always wonder about the way that an agent will characterize negotiations that they are having with the ownership. Because I bet that Scott Boras, knowing very well what kind of money he wanted to make, probably characterized conversations as, oh, they don't even respect you. I mean, and it is interesting how sometimes the way that somebody tells you someone else feels about you, which might not even be true, is going to be more true to you than the actuality of whatever happened then.
Yeah, I think that that's very well put, Paul. And that the truth of that and how Alex was made to believe or interpret all of the different actions. The third biggest lie, the number three lie on this list, is my favorite because it's just the funniest. It's the most hilarious, and it involves Rick Neuheisel. Rick Neuheisel, after the 2001 season, was interviewed by the San Francisco 49ers. Now, from what I've heard, this interview, which happened when Terry Donahue, who was Neuheisel's college coach at UCLA, was the president of the 49ers, included Bill Walsh. Everything I've heard, that Walsh was kind of like, I don't know about this guy's football acumen. Like, I'm not so sure that he was not blown away by Slick Rick. But Rick interviews for the 49ers job. He is seen in one of the Bay Area airports. I think it's SFO, but I'm not sure about that. By a guy that I worked with, John Levesque, who is a columnist at the Seattle Post Intelligencer, and their sports columnist. He's seen in the airport, and so there is a story that's written of, hey, Neuheisel, looks like Neuheisel interviewed for the 49ers job. Neuheisel comes back to Seattle. That's on a Sunday. On the Monday, the school goes so far as to release a statement saying that Neuheisel did not interview. He was in the Bay Area to play golf with friends and that he did not interview for the job. He goes on the radio and tells one of the people there, I did not interview for that job. I did not interview with the San Francisco 49ers. It turns out that the sports columnist, John Levesque, overheard his phone conversation in which he described the interview with the San Francisco 49ers.
See, that part of it makes me wonder about so many things. How did he overhear it? Did he proactively go try and overhear it? Or was it just he's walking down the street one day and then here's Rick Neuheisel? Oh boy, 49ers, this would be a wonderful opportunity. Like yelling it at the top of his lungs?
All of these things became huge sources of local conversation. Was Levesque eavesdropping? It was in a public place. He wasn't sitting in a phone booth. He was on a cell phone in the lounge of an. He clearly did not intend to be overheard by a newspaper columnist, but the newspaper columnist is within his rights to just sit there and what he heard, and his job's to report the truth. All of these things were funny. It included one of John Levesque's coworkers, also our coworker Jim Moore, referring to Levesque in print as the eavesdropper, which I don't believe John Levesque particularly enjoyed. And Levesque ends up writing a column of like, hey, look, he interviewed for the job. How do I know? Because I heard him talking about it. And then everybody freaks out again. And Neuheisel the next day had to go apologize to everybody he lied to. He had to apologize to his boss, Barbara Hedges. He had to call the radio station. He had to call the radio station to say, like, I told him his truth. And he tried to cover it up by saying that the 49ers had sworn me to secrecy And I thought in holding up that obligation that it was my duty not to reveal what had actually happened.
That's hysterical.
It was the funniest lie because it was just so straightforward and he had to come out at the end and say, I got caught telling a fib. I'm really sorry. It was like a 12-year-old got marched around. The highest paid employee of a university of the state is getting marched around to apologize for telling a lie.
That's the most awkward thing.
It's the most meaningless but my favorite of those lies. It's Danny Gallant. We're going to raise flags. That's coming up next.
From the pocket and flags everywhere.
Flag on the play.
Now there's a flag down.
Every morning at 9:45 with Danny and Gallant. Brought to you by Carter Volkswagen.
If the noise persists, the defense will be charged with a timeout.
Flag on the play.
It's been an eventful day here. Paul, you're being sent off onto vacation on hopefully a roaring high note.
Huzzah! Yeah.
You feel like that?
Yeah. Feeling pretty good, you know? Coming out of a birthday weekend and then about to travel somewhere else. I mean, I'm being as basic as it gets. I've essentially turned my own best friend's wedding into my own birthday week.
There we go. I would like to start by raising a flag to the Ginger Assassin. You might ask yourself who the Ginger Assassin is. He is a professional bowler. The Ginger Assassin wears a shirt with the red, white, and blue of the United States, waving flags, and there's a hammer on the front of it. There's a hammer on the front because, well, he is, and he drops the hammer. His name is Anthony Neuer. He's 18 years old, and he pulled off something that had only been done a handful of times, and anyone who's ever rolled a bowling ball down the lane can appreciate. It was a 7-10 split. Let's listen to it.
7-10 only been made on television 3 times in the history of professional bowling on TV.
Come on, kid, do it.
The Ginger Assassin just dropped the 7-10. You bet, kid. You bet. Oh, man. Give me some oxygen and water to spare the game. Brought to you by Guaranteed Rate. If you believe it, you can do it. Guaranteed Rate. Believe you will. I believe the Ginger Assassin can drop the 7-10.
It's like wow. The Bill Raftery of bowling.
With the kiss.
Fantastic.
Lingerie on the deck.
I also love hearing in the background some Pour Some Sugar on Me by Def Leppard just come out of nowhere. This is the exact kind of experience that I want if I were to go to a televised bowling event.
I don't know if they still own it. It was a bunch of Seattle Tech guys that bought the PBA. It was probably like 15 years ago. One of them was one of the Real Networks guys. One of them I had putatively worked before because he was at the way top of the hierarchy at a startup that I was working at. But yeah, they bought it with the idea of making it more marketable, and maybe the Ginger Assassin is the key to that.
Maybe. They need more Pete Webbers. Remember Pete
7,
Webber?
10, yes.
Who do you think you are? I am! Famous line that he dropped while he, I think, hit a strike, because I think that's all that happens in bowling. Strikes.
More, what do we got? Or 7-10 spares?
Ooh.
Spare of the game! 7-10.
I'm going to raise a flag to Julian Edelman for giving us such a rousing debate at 7:30, but also for the fact that he had to endure this story that I pulled sound from a while ago. It was an encounter with Bill Belichick late night at the Patriots facility in the hot tub.
Obviously, I came in the room to go in the hot tub, but then we made eye contact, and my natural instinct was to like turn around and like I was going to leave. But then I saw that he saw that I was in there, and then he got up and got out, and real, real big party foul by a coach. I mean, we're supposed to have shorts on. Supposed to have shorts. But I guess at 11 o'clock when you're the GOAT of coaching, you go wherever you want, free. So I had to hide my absolute face of terror after seeing what I saw.
Do you think Belichick was doing it as like some sort of assertion of dominance?
Well,
of
that's
like, you all have to wear shorts in the hot tub. I, as the head coach and emperor of this building, do not.
I am convinced that older folks in gym locker rooms, when those were a thing, before the pandemic walked around and always put their leg up on the bench.
Oh, yeah.
Entirely for that reason.
Yes.
To assert dominance and to make us look away, us youths.
Yeah. I completely think that's true.
I think
like, I don't care.
Locker rooms are different. I don't know what you guys are talking about.
What are women locker rooms like? Is there modesty?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
As a rule in men's locker rooms, the guys that should be most interested in covering up are least interested in covering up.
Yeah, that's a fair assessment. Yeah.
Right.
There like may the be guys a little that, of that too. I think once you get older, you just don't have any insecurities anymore. Who cares?
That's definitely part of it. I look forward and embrace the reality that if I'm not already that man, I'm going to become that man who's just like, I don't care. Whatever. Paul, what do you got?
My real quick flag. Look, I hate this time of year in the NFL because it leads to just stories that you know are kind of full of it. For example, the story that Trevor Lawrence already knows the entire Jacksonville Jaguars playbook. Quote.
That's not true.
Quote from Ian Rappaport reporting that the Jaguars have given Lawrence the playbook for the fall. He's already talking and retaining information like a member of the Jacksonville Jaguars. Awful. And it's just the start. And you're going to also get your other offseason stories of player X suffers devastating injury, looking the best he's ever looked.
Yep, that's exactly right. I want somebody to follow up with that. Like the first preseason game when Lawrence looks like a deer in headlights. Everybody's like, I thought you already knew the playbook, Trevor. What happened to all your studying? Did you forget it all? I want to thank Brock Heward for joining us today, the Professor John Clayton, Maura Dooley kept it on the straight and narrow, and seriously, my deepest thanks to Paul. I wish you the best on your trip. I hope you have a blast.
Thank you. I'm excited.
I really hope you have a blast. We'll look forward to seeing you on the other side.
All right. Sounds great. And if you have text for Puerto Rico, 710-710. Danny, I'll see you in about a week or so. Up next for me, should the Seahawks change the traditional draft habits that they have of trading back for this upcoming draft? You get to answer that question next, right here, 710 ESPN Seattle.